This is Peter Elting, The Limping Puer, March 12, 1999.
I've known Peter since 1996 when he joined our board and very capably put together our programs for us the last few years. He's relocated to San Francisco, so he is now just serving as an advisor to the board and no longer directly on the board, but we miss him on the board. He's next to the board. Yeah. Peter is a union analyst. He worked in the business world for over 20 years and then went to study at the Jung Institute in Zurich and also at the Institute for Psychodrama in Zurich. In his practice, he focuses on life transitions and dream enactment. He's a member of Union Analyst North Pacific, the International Association for Analytical Psychology, and the American Society of Group Psychotherapy and Psychodrama. And I hope you'll join me in welcoming Peter Elting and learning about the Puer.
Thank you, Karen. It's really fun to be here. The first limping act I have to do is find the right pair of glasses and get this machine going here. Do we need this, actually? Oh, well. We do. Okay. In order not to get completely lost in my extrovert intuitive thoughts, I have here wonderful 24 pages of notes, which I will not read to you because I don't want you to prematurely fall asleep, which is a limping puer syndrome. Or would be. But I'm really excited to be here in Seattle. I've had a wonderful time here and an association. And I need to say, as a disclaimer in the beginning, that while Karen Campbell in the newsletter said something about myself being a sufferer of chronic knee injuries, alluding to the fact that limping was something I'm eminently familiar with, you need to know that any resemblance of what I say to the presenter or speaker, totally coincidental. And it's up to your interpretation to make it happen. I admit, however, that I did have knee surgery last year. I admit that San Francisco was befallen by El Nino rainstorms. I admit to having had a leak in the kitchen that didn't want to quit. And I admit to having had a lot of sadness. My only brother died, some other friends died, so a lot of darkness. And as so often in our lives, whenever we become aware of something happening in the collective, then the inner process gets intensified. So one day I was indeed limping up the stairs from my knee surgery, and I have a wonderful dog by the name of Hans, who some of you know, and he has arthritis in the hip, and he also limped up the stairs. A neighbor saw us and said, "You really look like a wonderful limping pair." And by the time I had reached the top of the stairs, I had kind of forgotten that he said pair, and what stuck in my mind was limping puer. And I thought, well, this neighbor knows a lot more about Jungian psychology than I wanted to give him credit for. So the puer, I presume all of you are expert Jungians, and you know that the puer is the eternal boy, the youth, juxtaposed on the archetypal configuration, for lack of a better graphic, on the other side, being the senex, the older guy. Hi, you're not the older guy, are you? No. I shouldn't eat the mic? Okay. Is this better? This is better for you? Okay, for everybody, good. So can we really in our life only move on this continuum from the eternal young to the rigid senex? It would seem like a very limiting journey, and it is a journey that can hardly be satisfying to be just in this polarity of two archetypal images when they both are just two faces of the hero archetype. I think we live today in a very puer society. Juxtaposing it, I could call it a narcissistic society. Something that says about our continuous struggle to find authenticity in life, to look for an identity that we seemingly get continuously presented from the outside, but we're looking for it on the inside. So sometimes I will use Narcissus and the Pu'er interchangeably, but I will not go into detail into its fine differences, because there are indeed some very fine differences. Interesting, as I prepared for the lecture, and I was traveling in Costa Rica, a college president, a good friend of mine, was with me, and he sent me an email afterwards out of the blue, and he said, might you say that we have in rapid succession moved from the undiscovered Pu'er to the discovery of the child within, to the confusion of the Pu'er with maturity. Freud, Jung, who did this? With maturity, in parentheses, Mr. Clinton and every other exhibitionist on every talk show. By collapsing all boundaries between the inner and outer self, have we uprooted the tension that is basic to all culture? And I thought it was a very profound statement by somebody who just had to endure no more than 10 minutes of my limping Pu'er thoughts during a dinner in Costa Rica. He alludes to the possibility that indeed we have sort of created this pseudo-maturity that really isn't any. It's not without synchronicity that I talk about the limping Pu'er or the Pu'er syndrome per se in Sausalito, in Seattle. You can see the limp manifest itself in many ways. The synchronicity, to speak about the subject in Seattle, is signified by, you all will agree with me, that two major economic factors in Seattle are Microsoft and Boeing. Now, when we look at them, we could almost call them companies living off a Pu'er nature. They both dedicate their value to speed and flying and highness, and both of those are attributes to the Pu'er. So how apropos to speak about the Pu'er and its needed limp as a stage of reconciliation. And we will look at the Pu'er's need to limp. Before, let me remind you of the riddle of the Sphinx to further emphasize the need that we need to leave not only this polarity, but almost any other polarity that we have seemingly created in our postmodern society. You know the riddle of the Sphinx, don't you? You do? You don't? You do. You don't. What walks on four legs in the morning, on two legs at midday, and on three legs in the evening? Clearly three stages. And it is man in evolution. We crawl as a baby, we walk and run on two legs during life, and limp with a cane in one end during the eve of life. It's a fairly ancient riddle. Actually, I read as an apropos to it that the Sphinx, while we have consciously taken notice of it maybe during the last 2,000 years, indeed new analysis shows that it has been there at least 8,000 years, because it was 8,000 years ago that this part of Egypt was underwater for the last time. And they can clearly identify now with carbon pressing and other fine tools the watermarks on the Sphinx. And there are watermarks on the Sphinx. So it is really an oracle of substantial wisdom. So much has been written about the Pu'er, a lot of it rather negatively. You know, we always talk about flying, falling, crashing, and as much as I love Marie-Louise von France and all her writing, but her negative tint that she takes in the Pu'er Eternus, which is a very important seminal work that she wrote, where essentially, if I want to reduce it to one sentence, she says, you just got to cut the wings of the Pu'er and everything will be fine. Sounds a little castrating to me. Much more I like Jim Hillman's attitude in the Pu'er papers, which is very positive, emphasizing the creative and the spiritual being in the Pu'er. Before I confuse you totally, let me give you a couple of definitions that I use. We'll use the word self with a small s. It means ego structure. I'm giving it a very short, simple. The self with a big S, of course, is our Jungian favorite. It's the unknown, the effable, the all, the source of the origin. The puer is the new, the appearance of energies of the self into consciousness, the nascent ego, youthful creativity, playfulness, or a hopefully grandiose, narcissistic, and infatuated being. The Senex stands for a lot for discipline, to bring energies into reality. He can be a wise or a paranoid old man, knowing limits and knowing his limits, be the positive side, or starve in rigidity would be his negative. And any time I say puer, Senex, and I say he, I simply do it because I attempt to know myself, so I know he. I don't want to present this lecture as my she, so, but I mean puella as well. I mean she and he, and I mean hero and heroine. So you will forgive me when I just use for simplicity's sake. The puessenex polarity is neither good nor bad. Really, our ego stance gives it value. Hillman argues, and I agree with him, that you cannot divorce puessenex without losing its archetypal root. Puessenex are really just two faces of this very same hero archetypal configuration. The image of the limping comes up as a counterpoint to the speed, to the flying, to the grandiosity of the puer. It's a grounding limp. A grounding limp that can keep the puer from flying and falling. The limping stage for the puer is a necessary phase of reconciliation in the development. It's a precursor, in my opinion, to a more fulfilled life. We will talk later about the limping and in how much it implies wounding, because for the puer, it is somewhat of a wound. Old age still appears largely in today's society as an embarrassment. We don't want to talk about it. Geriatric numbers are growing, but we give just lip service to the need, to old, to the sick, to the handicapped. We establish special parking and handicap zones, but our addiction is to youth, everything youthful. The limping puer, with all his energy, I think is needed for the new millennium, because I don't think we can continue to run faster and attach value only to the speed with which we increase, whether it's our own speed or whether it's the speed of the computer. I'm getting a stiff neck. Small adjustment here. Wait a minute. So keeping this in mind, when I speak like this, do you hear just as well? Ah, so it is better? Softer. Well, let's by all means try and be softer here. As we move into the needed limp of the puer, you all know the Icarus who burns his waxed wings in the sun, a puer syndrome. And often, you know, the puer is defined by its negative attitude. We seem to be addicted somewhat to talking negatively about the puer. We also talk about the wounded narcissist. And it is always flying high and having no patience and grandiosity is what we hear. But I want to focus tonight on the creative side of the puer, the creativity for the youthful energy to be spontaneous, to care for people, to have a concern for the world, and to be a soulful and spiritual being rather than this omnipotent childhood self that we see so often. So as the limping puer, indeed, the puer is a very spiritual being. As the body, however, is no concern to him at all initially, often linkage points have to break down. And indeed, it is interesting to see, and we will see this later on also in mythology as we look at some of it, it seems to be already from thousands of years ago the favored start of a limp, of a grounding, of slowing down for reflection, is either a swollen foot or a broken leg or a broken knee, hardly ever any other body part. So what is the wounding for the puer? Would anybody do me a favor and collect all these Freudian slips so we could do the next lecture on them? I mean, here is a wounding Peter who is giving a lecture in Sausalito. When you read the title Limping Puer, I'm sure for most of you an image came up, some image, even if you didn't exactly know what is it. You may even have a sentence that starts like the limping is, and I want you to finish it. Keep it in mind, and let's talk about it later or tomorrow in the workshop. For me, the limping is a necessary transition to another phase in life that also sometimes can be the final one for the puer. Why not a limping senex? There's no reason why it shouldn't be the limping senex. I just feel more drawn to have the puer limp than the senex limp some more. They both belong to the same archetypal configuration. So we will now talk a little more and define the puer. What is the puer? And after that, we will look at some of the mythology. We will look at the wounding and the transition stage. Should I give this lecture in German, maybe? And conclude by attempting to pull together some of those thoughts to see in how far is this limp really a valid reconciliation point. I sort of wrote this somewhat grandiose, modest statement here that I want to read to you. I said, the limping puer will lead into the new millennium. He will have to resolve the either-or of the puer-senex axis. He will transcend into the spiritual while at the same time descend into the soul and the limp. New consciousness needs to at least the third as a potential birthplace for the completion. I imagine a dance between a limping puer and a limping senex as they happily marry and leave the axis onto which they have fought so many hard battles. Peter Pan and Captain Hook, a unity rather than a polarity. This I will try to prove to you in the course of the lecture, which of course I will not succeed, and you will be very happy. Von Franz said in her book, The Puer Eternus, the Puer Eternus, eternal youth, is the name of a god of antiquity. He's the divine youth who is born in the night in his typical mother cult mystery of Eleusis, and who is a redeemer. He's a god of life, death, and resurrection, and the god of divine youth. When I read this, I thought, I'm sorry, von Franz, I did you all wrong. This is a very fine definition. I like it. It's positive. It's divine. It does justice. However, right after that, she says, the man who is identified with the archetype of the puer eternus remains too long in adolescent psychology, that is, all those characteristics that are normal in a youth of 17 or 18 are continued later on into life, coupled in most cases with too great a dependence on the mother. So this is classical and also a somewhat developmental definition of the puer. And indeed, the puer is very much tied to the mother still, because he is arrested in what we could call a childhood self in its negative pole. But the positive pole that is born out of it is also his wonderful capacity to create, to play, to be that youth. So it is a trade-off. Narcissism is a basic Freudian concept that Jung borrowed to some extent. It's, of course, the myth of Narcissus who fell in love with himself. Not so bad in itself, but unfortunately, he did not know it. And that's what killed him. Jung started to write very little about the puer. He wrote in 1912 just almost a few sentences about it. And For him, it was largely the child archetype, the divine child. He did not pursue it any further, and I don't know whether it would be too brash to surmise that maybe Jung already at a relatively early age, as he teetotaled through his internship at Burgholzli, was already somewhat more attached to the Senex part of the pole. Or was maybe the puer a shadow of Jung? Did he maybe live his puer in his various relationships? Questions to ponder. So in our definition, we mostly rely on post-Jungians. And let me just now show you a couple of pictures of what I consider puer images.
This is, of course, just to bring it also into the control mind, is Peter Pan. It's interesting where in this rendition, when you look at it, Peter Pan has this flowery rose bush, and half the book doesn't get off so well. We talked about the youth culture and how it there is so much today. But we missed a grant that I think could do this model of throwball marriage. I didn't see an old man or an old woman in there. I feel this is what we strive for. I mean, it's a pretty hard competition. I don't think any one of those people in those paths that maybe wrote down is not here. I'm saying, here's the boys. Like I said. But,
a small rendition to warm us up to the puer. Sometimes also people say that the puer actually represents the mother's masculine quality. I'm going to let it stand as such. But the puer, who remains a mother's boy, will fail to engage the Senex pole at all. He will always stay on one side. Amongst other roots, von Franz traces the puer to early mother, lack of mothering, and the boy's emerging masculine being attacked, and so on. One thing the puer very much lives on is fantasies, recurring fantasies. And many writers, and also from my own experience with Anne Lizans, fantasies of grandeur, messianic qualities, spiritual election very often, genius, unusual creativity, fame and authority. I had a man in analysis once who consistently in his day fantasies dreamt of phenomenal business deals that he concluded, and he always came out on the best and right end of them. Wealth and success. It's a need of the puer to find a home for those aspects of the self that haven't constellated inside himself, because he did indeed get arrested at an earlier stage in childhood. So now these fantasies replace, these projections into other psyches replace these parts. In reality, though, when he leaves the fantasy world, he faces a lot of loneliness and doubt, self-doubt, before he can return to his creative and relating again. So during this period, the puer is actually not so spiritual. He's almost often quite depressed and slow. The attachment of the puer to the childhood self is quite intense, and it gets very, very difficult to get a sense of reality into this creative, prosperous being. New projects, puers love new projects, start 10 of them at the same time. It's just finishing is so awkward. It isn't that he doesn't want to do it. He would like to. Believe me, when you talk to them, they would like to. They're actually quite frustrated that it doesn't happen. But they lose energy. It's much easier to start a new one. This startup energy is so great. So you can see how easily we can get into some of those more negative aspects of the puer. I don't want to close out this aspect of describing the puer. Maybe share a dream or two of a puer. We all know falling, flying, and sometimes crashing seem normal material. I had an interesting dream an analyst told me in Zurich. It was the night before his wedding. He said, I'm flying on a straight back chair. I'm using the front leg as sort of a steering rudder. I fly over a group of businessmen dressed in proper suits. They try very hard to get me down and grab me. I cannot fend off their energy as I fly over them and come down as their hands reach up. Now, it's an interesting dream to have on the night before you get married. Imagine you're sitting in this chair, you're trying to run things, and you're trying to fly over all these people who obviously represent the conventional being tied down. He himself associated that he was very disappointed that he didn't have continuous energy to keep flying above them. He was quite distraught that he could see his unconscious fears of being tied down, being tied to the chair, being grounded. That's what marriage was for him. So I've highlighted a number of the more negative side, the negative face of the puer. But I had promised I wanted to move to the positive side, and I'm doing this now. So I cannot follow von Franz very much, because most of what I found positive comes out of the penmanship of Jim Hillman. In his Puer papers, he says, to that archetypal dominant which personifies or is in special relation with the transcendent spiritual powers of the collective unconscious, Puer figures can be regarded as the avatars of the self's spiritual aspect. It's also, as Hillman usually does, he packs about 5 pages into one sentence. So if you want the exact quote, it comes out of the Puer paper somewhere. In this positive quality, the connection to the self, I think, is that enables the Puer to be the mediator of special relationships. Those relationships that will help him to overcome the fear of fragmentation within. We need to restore this balance between the old and the young and the old, the puer and the cynics. My colleague and friend Anne Yeoman, who studied in Zurich, just finished a book called Now or Neverland, Peter Pan and the Myth of Eternal Youth. And she and also Hillman make clear that you cannot divorce the puer and the cynics. They are together already. So to just be tied to one pole is really living a limping life, but I'm using limping in a more positive sense. It is really living a very lame life, a very paralyzed life. The moment you can adapt both poles of this, and you can see,
you can in your own mind locate the limping pu'er. He's somewhere here. I don't want to be so linear and be saying he's right in the middle.
Hillman says, the archetype per se is ambivalent. The inherent opposition within the archetype splits into poles when it enters ego consciousness. You understood that? Not so easy. But I think what he means is that we allocate us to a large extent with these images to one pole or the other, the minute we think about these archetypal configurations consciously. The stage of the limping pu'er for me maintains the playfulness and the creativity of the pu'er. It does not do away with it or castrate it. Hillman said further, the soul is neither young or old, or is it both? Our contemporary obsession with age and youth reflects the fall of the soul into the time and measurement system of historical materialism. The pu'er inspires the blossoming of things. The senex presides over the harvest. But flowering and harvest go on intermittently throughout life. I think that's a wonderful quote to describe this whole dynamic. We really don't know who ultimately greets us, a gray-bearded old man or a golden young angel or no angel at all. I think only the limping pu'er gives us a chance that we have the capacity, when it comes to this point, that we have the capacity to greet either or both and embrace both. The pu'er is very spiritual. And it is spirit and meaning that are an ongoing question for the limping pu'er and for the pu'er. The pu'er is a spiritual phenomenon that needs to be looked at in relation to, also in relation to the father and not only to the mother. Other positive aspects, I think, coming also out of the penmanship of Hillman, says our angelic essence as messenger of the divine, what pu'er nature is. Our own first nature, our primordial golden shadow, a given sense of destiny and meaning. And I think it is in the quest for meaning that the grounding pu'er has its most difficult task to do. I think we can almost imagine those words I just read to you with some difficulty, because describing this aspect of the pu'er is difficult to describe. We don't want to lose this quality of creativity and spontaneity that the limping pu'er can harvest from being in the middle of being in motion as a point of reconciliation between the pu'er and the senex. It doesn't come without a price, because to hold the tension, as so often we know in Jungian work, also brings the dark side. The times when the pu'er is fragmented, when all the projections he has out in the world suddenly don't work out. The sensitivity of this creative young being is quite intense. Critique can unleash great loneliness for the pu'er and make him withdraw into stifling rigidity or total withdrawal. And we all have seen this maybe with some of our friends, where suddenly the energy shifts. We have a wonderful spirited discussion on great new happenings and something goes wrong, and if it's really a very sensitive pu'er type person, you will suddenly find like a wall coming down within 10 seconds. There's total withdrawal. It's like almost,
I experienced it once very strong. I even felt it in the body. It was like getting cold in the room. It is so strong. It is so strong. Because we are touching part of the self that is fragmented out there. That it's like if the self is nothing other than my inner being, then let's say, for simplicity's sake, I have it split into four parts, and three of them are projected out to you, you and you. And if you don't cooperate, if you get mad at me, or if you move away, I only have three left. So it is the loss of something that is really inside. So I think the limping puer, though, at least partially kept his capacity to fly, his spirits and creativity, is also capable to adopt the order and the discipline that comes from the Senex. The limp has given him a sense of reality and awareness of his body, which is very important for the puer to have, and a capacity to trust his own self to a larger extent than he normally would, and not so much rely on projected fragments. He has muted his intense need to be extroverted. He can at least spell the word introversion, and sees the old king sitting in the other room and has the desire and the capacity to occasionally visit. So let's forge on. Let's look at what does mythology, what does thousands of years of deliverance in oral and written tradition tell us? Analytical psychology has always enjoyed mythology, so we need to look at some. More so, I hope tomorrow we can work with those mythological images also in the workshop. Of course, who is there is Peter Pan. Peter Pan, Barry's book, written in 1906. Barry himself had a very Peter Panish life. His mother died at age 6 and he wasn't allowed to play much after that. So this Peter Pan figure represents a lot of the writer, as it so often does. He's a little boy who does not want to grow up, so he is not necessarily a puer. He's the spirit of perpetual youth. Peter Pan is also associated with the eternal youth, embodies childhood innocence, creativity, and spontaneity. And as such, it's a very important puer image. Anne Yeoman points out, she says, as a figure of the autonomy of spirit and creative fantasy, Peter Pan belongs to the archetype of possibility. As harbinger and agent of a new experience, he must suffer the pain of transformation repeatedly. The story isn't quite so perfect because it in some fashion also just polarizes the good youthful boy and the bad old grown-up Captain Hook. In Greek mythology, I was immediately drawn to Hephaestus. Hephaestus, he only partially fits maybe the image of our limping puer, as he was. Or are you there? He was born with a limp because he was thrown out of the Olymp twice. The first time he got away with it, he didn't really get damaged very much. He fell into the hands of some wonderful nymphs and sirens, and they nursed him, and he learned through his wonderful creativity to make all this great jewelry and artwork, which ultimately got him back into the Olymp because Hera, his mother, saw it, and I said, oh, this artisan, I want him back up here. So he came back up. But he hadn't quite lost his puerdom yet. He said, well, I'm going to get even with you. And he asked Zeus, would you hang her by her wrists? Well, he had underestimated her, and she, not this time, didn't gently push him out of the Olymp. She threw him down. And he was falling for a whole day, or was it two, maybe, I don't know. He had landed, and his legs were definitely broken this time. And being the divine that he was, he made himself golden leg supports to walk. He was kind of ugly, but his beauty came through his work and what he was doing, through his grounding. Hephaestus was a puer initially when he came back suffering from when he overcame his horrendous mother complex that cost him dearly. Then he overestimated his divinity. But in the end, Hephaestus was able to work, made his assistants out of gold, and he embodied the capacity to combine the spirit and the grounding of goldsmithing. The crippled one often is the creative one, similar to our concept of the limping puer. Prometheus. Well, you may be surprised that I'm bringing up Prometheus, and I see already foreheads wrinkling even through my semi-reading glasses here. He's not exactly a puer. I'm mentioning Prometheus for his aspect of being wounded and suffering. For the aspect that he's chained to the rock while during the day the birds pick his liver. He basically dies in great pain and suffers. And at night, he reconstitutes. Prometheus, in one sense, never reached the limping stage because he just refused. He had angered Zeus, which is a prevalent scenario in Greek mythology. And he continues to suffer during the day and rejuvenates at night, which very often, and that's why I mention it also, is a puer trait. Because those are the two sides of the puer. While his creative spontaneity and grandiosity is on one side, he suffers loneliness and self-doubt on the other side, and it is only in his limping stage that he can bring the two faces together. Now, another limping and puer type is Ulysses or Odysseus. As a boy already, Ulysses is wounded by his grandfather. So he has the wound. So in that sense, his wound seems like it's healed and scarred. But the puer is in total hubris after the Trojan War. He tempts the gods, and it takes him 10 years to get home to Ithaca. His Odyssey is well known and well documented, and his encounters with Circe and Calypso and various other goddesses and nymphs and sirens. But when he comes home, he's not quite the puer anymore. He's severely limping in a positive way. He dresses as a beggar to come back to Penelope. He doesn't come back as the golden hero that he left Troy initially. So it doesn't seem that Ulysses suffers any more from that one-sidedness that kept him 10 years at sea. There are many other gods and goddesses, and we could go on, and you know, as a Jungian, we love to do that. There's Egyptian mythology, there's German mythology, there's American mythology, there's puers here, there. Hermes, Dionysius are just a few that also definitely have puer traits. What is the wounding? Limping implies wounding. So what is that wounding? I think for the puer, any wounding, any slowing down, a wounding is any slowing down that leads him into an open space of aloneness. And then the road either leads to self-reflection or to loneliness. Because again, the hero, the source of his archetypal configuration, gets into the way because he wants to be active and fight rather than just sit and wait and reconcile. So the wounding is quite manifold. The wounding often is his inability to distinguish between reality and fantasy. His incapacity to finish things, the extreme extroversion, or in other words, his undeveloped introversion. Nothing he creates gives him a personal ego stance. His small S self is fragmented and lives outside, while his positive, creative, and spiritual sides also flourish. The limping puer realizes these capacities, both sides of them. The laming and limping of the puer also has specific parallels in mythology. The most prominent one, obviously, is Achilles. When we think and realize that Achilles' mother held her boy to make him invincible in a liquid, and only one spot on his body, the heel she held him, is where he's woundable, and that's where he gets wounded. And when we just stay with this image and see how often this happens to us, that by our own stance we get seemingly invincible, we have seemingly made it, but there is that one little spot in our armor that we have so carefully built that wounds us. It seems to, it goes on, I mean, there is the swell foot of Oedipus, there is Ulysses' leg, there is Hercules' foot, and Alexander the Great was wounded in the ankle, so you can see it's all sort of below the belt. The wounded foot definitely slows down the puer, the hero and the divine, and grounding takes place on an outer level. But I'm talking about it in a symbolic way to demonstrate that the reconciliation and the grounding needs to take on an inner place. The limping is necessary to soar again in spirit and consciousness. The over-identification with youth gets modified. While the wounding is physical, because we identify youth largely with virile, flying, leaping, tanned and coiffured images, and you remember the puer has no regard or relationship to his body. So thus the image of a wound of the puer always starts in the body that the puer really does not acknowledge. So is limping a necessary process? Can't I get through life without going through this limping, laming? I think limping enables us to be spiritual and materialistic, and by this I mean in the body at the same time. I think we begin to value that earthiness, that groundedness in the body, which for the puer is not only the ground or the body, but it is also the capacity to accept reality for what it is and not replace any real or reality happening with yet another fantasy. And I think the limping puer is necessary because most transitions and transitional models that you look at have another stage in it. They are tripartite. They are not stuck in a polarity like we could presume the puer senex is. The riddle of the Sphinx is the earliest rendition of it, which I mentioned in the beginning. Hephaestus, Achilles, Prometheus, and many other heroic figures and myth live with their wound. I'm kind of attached to the Odyssey because it's one of my favorite. So he embraces, as the beggar, he embraces youth, puer, and senex. In today's puer society, we just value youth and its attributes. We lift and paint our faces, we tan incessantly, we buy larger than needed SUVs and trucks to serve us on and off the road. We only give lip service to the old, the senex, the limping, outside laws, give handicap zones, street adjustment, disabled stickers, disabled access onto the street, into buildings. We find new words for the limping and disabled. We call it gently physically challenged. We don't die anymore, we just pass away. Our values are cathex to use and our self is projected outside. I heard a little story on the radio where sort of the typical up and whatever it's called, up and young up and coming or businessman drives down the freeway at 70 miles an hour and he hears a bad noise in the back of his car. Well, any one of us hopefully would stop, check out, see what it is, slow down. No, he cranks up the speed and turns up the radio so he doesn't hear the noise. Isn't it wonderful? A soulless life it can be, unless you can learn how to limp. The limping puer is the beginning of a transcendent completion of union of opposites and brings with it a slow descent rather than a fall or a crash. There is nobility in the limping puer, as he is capable in bringing the energy of the puer to earth, ground it, and keep its spirits and creativity. That is why we have to learn to limp. As I was working on this, and whenever I work on a lecture, but while I love to lecture, preparing for it, I wish somebody else would do it. But it doesn't work that way. But I also incessantly then talk to all my friends. All my friends have endured this lecture already many times over. They have read it in parts and pieces, and many of them I'm very much indebted to their feedback. One of the most meaningful came from my good friend and mentor John Nicholas, who was also up here lecturing after he had his stroke. And he was indeed limping and laming. His whole right side was laming. Just a week ago, I had lunch with him, and we talked about the lecture. And he said, "Peter, it is of amazement to me that now that I'm paralyzed on one side, I can barely walk with a walking stick. I have dreams where I'm running on the beach and driving off, and I'm perfectly healthy." And he says, "I love those dreams." I said, "John, you are indeed the true limping puer that I know." And he said, "I know, because what it shows me, this dream, is that psychologically and spiritually, I'm running on the beach, and I'm limping with the body only." I'm coming to the end. So to conclude my thoughts, I want to ruminate a little bit about this limping puer into the new millennium. I kind of become somewhat melancholic about the prospect as we go into the new millennium, because we do need to find a grounding limp to continue on, because as I said earlier, we can hardly just continue to speed. We can hardly just be a puer, and then we don't like it, discard it like an old suit and fall into some rigidity. We need to look at the positive qualities that I highlighted earlier. We have the chance for the first time in a long time to experience transition and millennium in one generation. It's a momentous occasion. It is not good enough to just clip the wings of the puer or any creative spirit in us. We all need this youthful spirit. We need to work with it. And that's why I feel that we need the constellating third. We need the limping puer to do it, who also has the discipline and knows his limitations. It is indeed a point of reconciliation. So we have extensively looked at the polarity of Puer and Senex, both being intertwined from the hero archetype. What might sameness feel like? What might union of opposites feel like? What might it feel like to juxtapose limping Puer with transcendent function? For those uninitiated, it's a very big Jungian term. I'm not going to try and explain it in two sentences. But what it means I will try and explain it, sorry, I will. what it means we transcend one side, and rather than moving to the other, we transcend both and formulate a third out of the two, negative and positive alike. We merge it into the new. And in this spirit, Hillman and others and Jung also found a wonderful saying in the Renaissance. It's called festina lente. Any of you heard that? Festina lente, literally translated, means make haste slowly. And I think this is like a Japanese koan, because that's the struggle. If we struggle to get this image, we rightfully do so. But it presents sort of an ideal ego position with the two-faced archetypal image intact. An image you can only attain if your puer nature stays intact, because the union of sames, for me, is the limping puer. I think the limping puer is a wonderful being, able to fly without getting his wings burned, because his wings aren't made out of wax anymore. He's able, like Hephaestus, to be ugly, admit it, and create beautiful things. As the millennium nears, and we are largely still in a puer societal structure, somewhere I wanted to abbreviate it, but I'm going to stay away from that, or our culture of narcissism, I think we need to be aware that we are captured by a cult of youth and commodification of personality in contrast to substance. Corporations consume the puer energy and get rid of old people. TV personalities are almost always youthful. Where do the old people go? Most people seem to be getting ready for market or something equivalent. The audience is all important. What happens? The puer would continue to fly and fall. More crashes would make life difficult. Death is more probable. Ultimately, it wouldn't work. The limping puer can escape, I think, this spider web and reach an individual sense of wholeness. It is definitely a preferred side to the either-or, because it is the either-and-or. The limping puer can really enjoy real life. The archetypal patterns around the puer are very strong to support it, as they touch not only on the hero archetype, but also on archetypal configurations of mother, divine child, and hero. So I definitely think that the limping puer will lead us into the new millennium, and that he will have resolved the either-or of the puer-senex axis. He will transcend into the spiritual, while at the same time descend into the soul and limb. And you remember I said this in the beginning, and I want to repeat it, as I had mentioned it, that I imagined the dance between the limping puer and the limping senex on that same axis. And you can see there's plenty of room to dance. Peter Pan and Captain Hook as a new unity. And I, for myself, I'm actually very proud of the roadmap on my face. You know, I don't want to do anything with it. Although even my Kaiser medical plan doctor said the other day, this eyelid droops quite a bit. We should fix that, and then we can fix the other one too, and maybe get these bags out a little bit. Imagine, a health plan is offering this to me. Isn't this wonderful? As you drive by an automobile junkyard, you will see a lot of useless, rusting old cars, and you say, my God. But then when you realize that you yourself, or I myself, I'm 61 years old. And then suddenly you realize, at that age, you're a valuable antique. Earlier, Hillman had so wonderfully described the puer. And I'm going to repeat part of it, but then I'm going to continue on it. He had said, if you recall, if the puer inspires the blossoming of things, and the senex provides the harvest, and now comes elting, then I feel the limping puer will cook the fine meal you need to live an individuated life. So you've been very patient to listen to my ruminations, and I hope I haven't... See, I lost my watch in the process, so I don't even know whether I'm over time or under time. This is how engrossing this... Oh, I think we're almost on time. But in ending, I want to say, I want to thank you for sharing these ruminations, and I hope we have a wonderful discussion after a short break. I'm not quite through yet, so I don't want you to run up yet. I looked, of course, for an image of the limping puer, and I looked high and low in my house and in all the wonderful books of alchemy and Jung. And lastly, I found one, and I want to share those two images with you.
Now begins the discussion session. The questions, in most cases, are not heard over the microphone, but Peter Elting's replies are.
That is so close to one's heart that I looked not only specifically for, you know, material that is apropos to this specific subject, but all sorts of other stuff comes up. So what I forgot at the end, one never forgets. What I thought I didn't want to say at the end of the lecture, but want to say now as we sit down and informally discuss some of the things, I found a poem. A poem, really, that reflects this whole lecture in a most wonderful way. It's anonymous, as most of the things I've presented tonight, totally anonymous. It's entitled Man in the Mirror, or Woman in the Mirror. When you get what you want in your struggle for self, and the world makes you king for a day, just go to the mirror and look at yourself and see what the man has to say. For isn't your father or your mother or your wife whose judgment upon you must pass? The fellow whose verdict counts most in your life is the one staring back from the glass. Some people may think you're a straight-looking chum and call you a wonderful guy. And the man in the glass says you're only a bum if you can't look him straight in the eye. He's the fellow to please, never mind all the rest. For he is with you clear up to the end, and you passed for a more difficult, dangerous test if the man in the glass is your friend. You may fool the whole world down the pathway of years, and you get pats on the back as you pass, but your final reward will be the heartache and tears you cheated the man in the glass. I'm going to leave a couple of copies of it with the managing directors of the Jung Society. And you have to negotiate with them to also get copies of it if you so desire. So here we are, limping right along in Sausalito. This was a very living subject for me, and I would love to hear images and ideas and critiques and laudatios and anything from you. Pacifica, yeah. How was it? Is he still a puer? Admit it. He wouldn't. What do you think? He was stubborn? He admitted that. That's good.
Yes. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Yes. Right. I'm not here. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you have maybe a smaller question that I could start with? A comment. Well, they're definitely interrelated. I would say just offhand, and I still have my esteemed Jungian colleague here, so he can always correct me. I would think for me, anima, I have to preface it. For me, anima and animus are one in a way. I don't go with this strictly female-male interpretation. I think man has both and women has both. So that's one thing I want to say to that. The other thing I want to say to that is that for me, the puer definitely has that quality, especially when I think, what was it, Hillman or somebody said, the puer as an avatar of the self, a one that connects the messenger, this quality of the anima to connect unconscious and conscious. I think the puer in that aspect as the Arkdharma has a lot of that also. Some other people may have an idea about that. It's a very good question. Thank you. It's very apropos to make that, or attempt to make that connection. Yes, please. How this plays out in the clinical practice in life? Well, very often it comes through what you remember we talked about. Some of what is this limp, what is this wounding, and in most cases that I experienced, one or the other, either symbolically, meaning as a psychic process, or in actuality, happened. A glimpse of the dark side, a glimpse of the mortal self, the brother, because that is the unrealized brother of the puer, is that dark part. So the limping puer also has the capacity to think about death, to think about mortality, because the puer per se does not recognize that. So I think it is that glimpse of the darkness or the mortality that is the beginning of that process. And it is a long process, because if you ever have clinically worked with people who are very puer-like, or maybe to use more of a term that we hear so much, narcissistically wounded, it is very, very difficult to get a sense of reality into people, because it means to confront the wound over and over and over again. Thank you. You had a question? Yes, please. Uh-huh. Yeah. No, it's, very similar. This imagery holds up when you see people from, to use another Jungian aspect, from a typological standpoint, when they're totally misplaced. You know, you're trying to make an accountant out of an extrovert, intuitive person, and you have nothing but fire water going on and triple bookkeeping. Humor, I find, we talked about clinically, because I use humor a lot in that work, and in working with narcissistically wounded or puerta people, humor helps them a lot because it does bring in this archetypal fool quality that gives them then the license to say something or do something that otherwise they would never dare and admit and do. I think has not been worked on enough, especially in this connection of how important a humor or a fool approach can be really as a treatment. No, it just came to me. It's brand new. You heard it here. But think about it. It's a very natural evolution for me. Another big one. Oh, I love to. Humor for one. You just have to be very patient and give them really an empathic listening to every time these fears come up. The puer has only helped in his work when he works therapeutically, analytically, if he, more than any other person, has really a true empathic reflection and understanding by the person he's sharing his fears with, what happens when I crash, when I don't have these grandiose fantasies, I have no life. When I don't project myself out to the others, who am I? I have no ego structure. Now, because of this sensitivity, it is very difficult and very tough work therapeutically, because you cannot afford to not be attentive and doze off. The puer will pick it up right away. And he will immediately insinuate is or experience it as a criticism. And that is the worst thing. The minute this criticism comes in, you will find the air grow cold in the consulting room again. Because that's that early wounding again, that criticism that makes total withdrawal. So, yes. And I want to, I don't know the exact sign up, but I certainly want to invite all of you to come and play a little bit tomorrow. I just want to say a few words what I plan to do. That doesn't mean that that's really what I'm going to do. But something like it. We will be together as a group, and I have absolute love for enactment and psychodrama, and I trained as a Jungian psychodramatist, the only one of its kind so far in the States. So I combine both of the deep archetypal patterns with playfulness. And what a better way to do it with a limping puer or a limping puella. So think about it. If it rains again and it's cold, great time to come from 10 to 2. Price is right. Enough sailing. But more questions? Thank you. But is there a last question? Are we quitting, Karen? Oh no, I wasn't going to wrap it up. We still have some time if there are questions. Not to me, it wouldn't be. And that is not to say that, you know, we have to divorce ourselves from the fact that we're talking about a woman or a man. We're talking about, at best, a feminine and a masculine aspect. So as such, and as an archetypal configuration, I would flock to the interpretation and saying it does apply to puer and puella likewise. So I wouldn't want to get stuck on it. But I'm sure there are finer differences. If a woman colleague of mine would give this talk and she would focus on the puella, she would probably be able to look at the finite differences. But also in literature, or what Jung has written, puella is a post-Jungian term. Jung never used it. So, Rick. Does a puella mother give birth to a puer? Yes, very easily. Yes and no. I tend to agree with you to some extent, or I think that feels right, but I also feel that the birth mother of a puer often is one that is more dominating and rigid. So that would lead me to more of a crone quality, a senex quality, rather than, because as a mother child, if it is really a true puella, she would very much, I think, in her relationship to the child, as the child grows up quickly at various stages, have this tremendous capacity to relate. So the child would really get a lot of mothering from the puella. So it would be more of a crone, you know, as von Franz had pointed out, that often the puer, you know, gets born by a by an early cutoff of his masculine development, or castration even, she uses that word. Or of course, where the masculine father or the father per se may be absent. Yeah. And I mean, I think, and the whole thing also gets very much, in my opinion, influenced, and I think I brought it out in the lecture a number of times, by this tremendous, tremendous puer, in quotation mark, pressure we feel from society. You know, we are this addicted youth society. You know, aged baroque maps on body or in the outside world are basically still not acceptable to us. We don't look at them as something valuable. I guess only old analysts are becoming valuable. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, we're basically throwing away tradition and mythology, where the wise old man is really the image we should look at, or the wise old woman. Robin. Really? Hmm. Well, I think it has also a lot to do with some, we would say, well, women in general have, of course, maybe a better access to the to a feeling, empathic function than many men do, also professionally. And that helps in accepting criticism, I think, because it is the softer side. I mean, you know, if you have a very rigid nature that many of us men have, because we're brought up this way, to succeed and have an identity and a big fat ego in it and live off knowledge and knowing it better than the other person, then criticism is pretty hard to... where do you put criticism in there? I mean, even if you preface it 10 times and saying, this is, I only mean this as a very constructive suggestion. Well, it doesn't work. You know, it's the same thing. What do you mean? You don't like what I'm doing? Not doing a good job? And I think women are, by and large, much better in that, much more open. Did you? And stayed there, right?
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.